My name's Ed, and I'm an alcoholic.
Yes.
I got a cheat sheet with me, and I'm not going to read from it. This keeps me from going down rabbit holes, which I contend to do. And I don't want to do the whole deal on my drunkalogue, because we all have one. John, you surprised me. John's comment to me after the very first meeting was I was a friggin' fanatic, except he didn't say friggin'. But I told him five suggestions, and one of them was 90 meetings in 90 days, and he thought that was a terribly inconvenient thing for me to ask him to do. But let me back up a little bit. I was raised in a military family. My dad was one of the world's biggest jerks. He was raised by another one of the world's biggest jerks. And I'm not saying that out of meanness or in any way to denigrate him, other than to say that's the way I was trained to be one of the world's biggest jerks. I didn't know any better. And that's the kind of family I grew up in. My dad was volatile. I never knew what to expect out of him. Once somebody asked me, where was my mom? And my answer was, she spent her time in her foxhole, which was the very safest place for her to be. Some of you may be able to connect with that. I was asked once where I got my self-esteem, because I'm supposed to get it from my parents. And many of you may connect with this as well. And it was a really good question to ask me. I got it from scout leaders, teachers, church leaders, parents of my friends, but I never really got it at home. I was kind of an overachiever trying to get that self-esteem, that compliment especially from my dad. But I got one compliment from him in my whole life. It was on June 9th, 1969. It was the day I graduated from college, and he said, I'm proud of you. And to the best of my recollection, that's really the only time he ever paid me any compliment of any sort. When I left home for college, and I was still not a heavy drinker as a high schooler, and even though I grew up on the Mexican border, I left home 5 days before my 18th birthday. I had my first car I ever owned, which was a beautiful 1956 Chevy Bel Air convertible. Yeah, today they tell me the damn thing's supposed to be worth $55,000 or $60,000, but I bought it for $400 and sold it for $250. Anyway, I went off to the University of Wisconsin on a Navy ROTC scholarship, and I got to Wisconsin on my 18th birthday. I'm sitting in my new dorm room, and a couple of guys came by and said, hey, Ed, let's go out for a drink. And I said, it's my birthday. And they said, let's go out for a drink. And I said, I can't. I said, I'm only 18. And they said, well, don't you know that Wisconsin is an 18-year-old drinking state? And I didn't know that. When I applied to school at the University of Wisconsin, I didn't know that. It was really a wonderful thing to find out, because we went down to a place called the Badger Tavern, and so for my first night of responsible drinking, they said, you know, there's this new thing out called Colt 45. It comes in quart bottles. Why don't we get you one? So they bought me a quart bottle of Colt 45, and I had three of them that night before they threw me out of the bar. I drank alcoholically every time I could from my 18th birthday on. I wasn't obsessed with it, and I didn't drink daily until probably right before I graduated from college. But liquor was a great thing. I got out of all the things that bugged me all the time. From the time as far back as I can remember, there were monkeys in my head talking all the time. You did this wrong. You did that wrong. What's tomorrow going to be like? Oh, they're going to catch up with you on this. And it's just thing after thing after thing all the time. And there was no way for me to quiet those monkeys down until I found alcohol. They quieted them down, and they allowed me to go to sleep when I went to bed. If I didn't drown the monkeys before I went to bed, it was likely an hour or two and sometimes three before I could fall asleep. So I wasn't a very well-rested guy. When I graduated from college, I joined the Navy. And, there's one thing that the Navy does really, really well. Drink. You know, that may not be the case anymore. I understand the Navy frowns on drunken sailors anymore, but a drunken sailor is what I was. We went to lots of ports in and around the Pacific Ocean. It was during the Vietnam War. I got to spend a little time in sunny Southeast Asia, which is why I get to use a cane today. But I drank my way through the Navy. And when I got out of the Navy, my intention was to stay in the Navy and become a four-star admiral when I joined the Navy. That was what I wanted to be. I found out very quickly that I had gone to the wrong college to be a four-star admiral. It's not the case today, but back then, if you wanted to be the Navy's top dog, you had to go to the trade school named Annapolis, you know. And today it's still pretty much true. But there have been some chief of naval operations that have come from other schools. But I found out that I wasn't going to be able to do it, so I got out and because I was going to run General Motors. So I got a hit. I went to Southern Methodist University on the GI Bill and got an MBA. And I graduated and got married at the same time. I was unemployed because it didn't occur to me you're supposed to interview for a job. I was too busy drinking. So I got married when I was unemployed to a lady who had a five-year-old son. And her father asked me just before the wedding how I was intending to support his wife and grandson, or his daughter and grandson. And I said, you know, just trust me. Trust me. How many times have any of us said, yeah, trust me, right? I was 27 years old, and I had a goal. My goal was to be an officer in a Fortune 500 company and have a net worth of $1 million by the time I retired, by the time I was 65. And I was 27 years old. Well, I went to work, and I got promotions fairly quickly. And by 1983, 8 years later, I was an officer in a Fortune 500 company, and I had a net worth of over $1 million. And I thought, I had arrived. I don't know if any of you have ever seen that sentence in any of our literature. Yeah, Phil said it. But I had arrived. The goose hung high. You know, everything was great. And I was drinking like a fish. I drank like mad during this entire time. In 1989, working for this company, and I'd been promoted once, and I was a senior vice president, and the Vice President of Human Resources came up to me and said, Ed, you need to find another way to let off pressure. And I said, Al, I got a great way to let off pressure. I don't need it. I don't need any help. And he just let it go. I know, in retrospect, that what he was telling me is I had to get my drinking under control. But back then, this was 1987, there weren't any employee assistance programs. You know, it was just like it is described in the big book today. You know, if you can't keep yourself sober, we're going to fire you. You know, it's that simple. Well, I hung around for another 6 months, and they fired me. And that was the beginning of a long slide. It took me 8 years to get up to the top, or what I considered the top, 1988. And it took me until 2002 to crash that train, or to wreck that plane, or whatever you want to call it. It was a long, slow crash. It was a slow motion train wreck. And in ensuing 12 years or whatever it was, 14 years, I drank up all the savings. I drank up the house. I drank up my family. I drank up every relationship I had, with exception of the one with my wife. And on September 29th, 2002, my wife threw me out of the house and told me she never wanted me to come back. She'd never done that before. I think she'd talked with an Al-Anon, got that idea. So I was kind of homeless, but I was still working. I was still faking my way through a bunch of jobs, and I was doing a consulting job in Oklahoma City, living in Dallas. So what I was doing, I had an apartment in Oklahoma City. I was commuting back and forth between Dallas and Oklahoma City on weekends. So I went up to my apartment in Oklahoma City, and I stopped at a car wash on the way, and I felt lower than whale shit on the bottom of the ocean. I just felt really low. Dead looked really good, and I was just too chicken to do anything about dead. It occurred to me to just take all the money we had left in savings and take off and just go drink. Where nobody'd bother me, nobody'd bitch at me about drinking too much. Nobody told me I had to get up in the morning. No boss to work for. That's all I wanted to do. Just go drink myself to death. That was my state of mind. When I got to Oklahoma City, it was about a 3-hour drive from Dallas, and I took my car into a car wash to get it clean, and I walked across the street to a pizza joint. It's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I went in and I ordered a beer. And I sat there for the hour. It's one of those car washes that takes about an hour to detail it and everything, get through it. And I sat there, and I didn't drink a quarter of that beer in an hour. I have no idea what was going on with me. There was a part of me that said, I want to drink that beer. And I took some sips, which should have triggered what we call the allergy, to get me to start dumping them down my throat. But I couldn't finish that beer. I didn't know what was wrong with me. It really bothered me. The last thing my wife said when the door to my house hit me in my butt was, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went back to the apartment I had, and I opened up the phone book, and I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called them. And a really nice lady said, well, where do you live? And I told her, and she said, oh, you know, we got a meeting that meets in about 15 minutes, not even a quarter of a mile from where you are. Why don't you let me send somebody over to pick you up? And I said, no, I'll do it tomorrow. But I decided I really wanted to go to AA tomorrow, the next day, because I didn't know what was wrong with me. I went to work. That was the next day. It was a Monday. I went to work, and I went to AA that night, and I took a can of beer out of the fridge, and I popped the top, and I got in my truck and drove to the AA meeting, and I had a couple of sips of that beer, and I really didn't like it. And I left that beer sitting in the truck while I went to the AA meeting. And something really interesting happened in that AA meeting. There were a bunch of bikers in this AA meeting. And it was a summer night, summer in this part of the country, right? And they were in vests, and they were sweaty, and they were hugging each other. And I thought, Jesus Christ, what kind of a place have I gotten myself into? But they gave me 5 suggestions that night. And I don't remember, I know I didn't write them down that night, but I wrote them down sometime in the next 3 or 4 nights. And the 5 suggestions were these, if I can remember them off the top of my head. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Get a big book and read the first 164 pages. Get a sponsor. I didn't know what one of those was. Pray and don't drink between meetings. Yeah. I read the 12 steps on the wall up above the speaker stand, and it had, God was in 7 of those. So I decided, well, I don't have to do those. I'm going to do 5, but I'm not going to do those God steps. And after the meeting, 4 or 5 guys took me out for coffee and a piece of cake. And what happened to me with those 5 guys was the same thing that it talks about in the big book. The identification of what they'd done, what their lives had been like. And I thought, you know, these guys really have some. It kind of excited me. And I decided I was going to go back to a meeting the next night. So the next night, I was kind of excited about this. This was neat. These guys were happy. I didn't know what happy was. So then the next night, I should tell you, when I got out of work every day, my habit was I had a cooler. I put 2 cans of beer in the little cooler and put it in my car during the day so that when I got out of work, I had enough beer to get me back to the apartment that I lived in, which was 4 blocks away. I'm not kidding. I slammed those first few beers down every day, every time. But I wasn't doing it on this Tuesday. I didn't even take a beer with me. And I went back to my apartment and I waited for that 8 o'clock meeting. And I popped the top on a can of beer and I had about 2 or 3 sips of that can of beer and drove over to the meeting. And this guy named Randy came up to me after the meeting and he said, you know, if you can go without a drink till tomorrow night, He said, I'll meet you here. And I thought that was kind of nice of him. I didn't know that was a hook we set at a lot of AA meetings, you know. If you can go without a drink, and I'll meet you here. But that's what he said. And I said, you know, I've not voluntarily gone without a drink for 24 hours for several decades. I said, I don't have a clue how to do that. And he said, well, you pray. And I said, oh, I don't believe in God. And he said, that's okay, God believes in you. Now, there's a really amazing statement. You know, so I went back to my apartment, and I didn't drink any more of that beer that was sitting in my console on my truck. And I said this prayer that said that went something like this. All right, God, I don't think you exist. But they tell me if I say a prayer and tell you I don't want to drink anymore, that I'll get some help in not drinking anymore. But I don't think this prayer is going to work worth a shit. Good night. And that was it. And I went to bed. And I haven't had a drink since I said that crappy prayer. Yeah. This has nothing to do with me, guys. Nothing. You know? Now, I still pretty much hold that I'm not a big believer in God, as many of you may understand God. But I'm an atheist with a higher power, and I have an understanding of something that keeps me sober. And I gave the universe that night, I told the universe the very deepest thing I had in my heart, the very deepest desire there was. Because I'd lost something to me that was more important than alcohol. There's a story in the big book, and I can't remember the page number. But it says, our bottom is when we have just lost or about to lose something more important to us than alcohol. And I did not know it. I'd never thought about it. But my wife was more important to me than alcohol was. And I was absolutely devastated that I'd been thrown out of the house and told never to come back. So I was at that bottom, and I didn't want a drink. I wanted my wife back more than I wanted a drink. So I decided I was going to do this deal. And I went back to this group Wednesday night, and I tried to find Randy, and he didn't meet me there, the SOB. But there were about 80 people in this meeting, and there had been about 20 people in the Monday night and Tuesday night meetings. But there were 80 people in this meeting. It was a men's meeting. More bikers. And they all sat in Oklahoma City before. The habit is everybody introduce themselves at the beginning of a meeting. If it takes 15 minutes, everybody introduces themselves. They go all the way around the room. So I was sitting in the back corner, in the back right corner of the room. And they were, you know, Bob alcoholic and Joe alcoholic and Bill alcoholic, yada, yada, yada. And they got back to me back here, and I said, my name's Ed. And it was silent for a minute. And then it went on around, and this chairman of the meeting, and I think he saved my life. He said, hey, you Ed. And, oh, crap. He said, this is a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, I mean, he could have told me the purposes were swimming up Niagara Falls. That didn't mean anything to me. He said, do you have a desire to stop drinking? And I said, not really. And he said, well, I'm going to have to ask you to leave the meeting. And to this day, I still get the feeling that I had then. The thought that rushed through my mind was, and a chill through my body, Jesus Christ, to throw me out of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. How low can you go? And I stood up, and I said, my name's Ed, and I'm an alcoholic. That was my first step. Taken in front of 80 guys who stood up and gave me a standing ovation. I'll never forget that. Talk about positive reinforcements, more than I ever got from my dad, I tell you. So the night before I'd taken my second step, came to believe in a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity. And the sanity is simply not taking another drink. It's insane to take another drink. I know exactly what happens when I take another drink. And that is, I don't know what's going to happen. Every time, without fail, I wake up in strange cities. I wake up with strange people. I don't know where my car is. I went out with trick-or-treating one night with my kids. And my overcoat, we lived in Minnesota, my overcoat pocket stuffed with cans of beer. And I came back home when my beer cans all got empty, but without the kids, I'd lost them, you know. I mean, I was pathetic. I was pathetic as my dad was. So here I was. I took that second step. I took the first step in front of a bunch of guys. And frankly, the way I interpret the third step is making a decision to go ahead and do the program. And I'd made a decision to go ahead and do the program. So they told me to find a sponsor, and I spent about 4 months looking for a sponsor because I needed somebody who was like me. But I finally found somebody who was like me, who had a business background like me, who reached the bottom, someone like mine, and he walked me through the steps. And I did not know it at the time, but Mike was an evangelical Christian, and he let me be a agnostic, atheist, I don't know what I was, but he led me through the steps without trying to convert me one way or the other. He just told me, go read, go seek. Go find stuff. You know, it's yours. The God of your understanding is to be the God of your understanding and not anybody else's. Now, not bad. I did the whole drunken dog and got ahead of myself. All right, very good. Okay. Well, my wife, the kind lady that she was, we didn't talk, but she Federal Expressed all the bills to me every Friday. And my paycheck went into two accounts. One was mine and one was hers. So hers kept flowing, and I kept getting the money to pay the bills. And for 3 weeks, that went on. And I called her in the fourth week because our 28th anniversary was coming up. Do you believe that woman put up with my alcoholic behavior for 28 years before she threw me out? I mean, she is really a good Al-Anon. She's got this enabling business down really pat. She thought her love could sober me up. And she didn't have any idea that what she was up against was more powerful than she was, and it was far more powerful than I was. But I called her up, and I said, our 28th anniversary is this Friday. I said, I'd like to go out to dinner. And she said, well, we can go out to dinner, but no promises. Don't get your expectations up about anything. So we went out to dinner. We had a nice talk. And I was allowed back in the house on weekends. I'm going to talk a little bit about the steps, but not a whole lot. Mike took me through the steps. I screwed around on the fourth step like everybody else does. I spent about 4 months trying to design the perfect form, you know. And then one day Mike said, what are we waiting on? And I said, I'm working on the form, trying to get it right. And he said, the form's in the big book. He said, that's all you need. The form's in the big book. Just do it. Four columns. Boom, boom, boom. And then he said, we're going to do your fifth step in 2 weeks from today. And the fear of God ran up my spine because I hadn't written anything down except trying to play around with this funny form. But I spent a lot of time on my fourth step. I tried to go through it as completely as I could. Because in the big book, the sentence that sticks in my mind is in the fifth step, right after the fifth step. And it says, if we skip this vital step, we will drink again. And that scared the crap out of me. I didn't want to do that real bad. So I did as thorough a job as I could on that fourth step, and we sat down on two Saturdays from the time he told me. And we sat down at about 10 o'clock in the morning, and we were still going at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And I think he fell asleep once or twice while we were, you know. So it was all about me, right? All the neat stuff that I did in my life. You know, the time that I went out drinking in Miami and I woke up the next morning in the Bahamas and I'd taken four people with me. You know, the four DWIs, you know. One night in Milwaukee, I went out drinking on a Friday night. I got arrested. I was in and out of jail. The guys at the jail got so worried that I was going to die, they sent me to a hospital. My friends came looking for me, found me at the hospital, and the hospital said, the guy's, he's so far gone, he said, there's no way we could pump his stomach because it all had been ingested. He's either going to live or he's going to die. Here, you take him. If he dies, here's the coroner's number. And I woke up Sunday afternoon about 5 o'clock. I won a bet, by the way, that day. I bet a guy $5 I could drink a fifth of brandy faster than he could, and I won the bet, okay? I got 4 DWIs during all that time I was drinking. It's amazing I didn't get many, many more. Life was a lot softer on DWIs in the 60s, 70s, and 80s than it is today. And it was before computers. So every time I got a DWI, it was in a different place. Nobody ever knew I had another one. And, of course, when the judge asked me, you ever had one of these before? I said, no, Your Honor, no way. I never went to jail. The worst I got away with was my last DWI in 1989. It cost me $1,000, court costs, lawyer's fees, everything. That was it. My first one cost me $150 in 1969. So it's changed a whole lot. The country's become intolerant of us crazy people driving around on their roads killing others. And they're right. You know, I was getting away with murder, and so were other people. As a matter of fact, in Texas, at one point a lawyer told me if I ever ran over somebody and killed them, the first thing I should do is run into the nearest bar and buy a fifth and pour as much of it down my throat as I possibly could. Because the penalty for killing somebody while you were drinking was far less than it was if you just ran over them when you were sober and had all your faculties about you. Okay. The world has changed. Shitload. I'm a lucky guy. Anyway, I told Mike all these stories. He about fell asleep. At the end of the whole ordeal, he stood up and all he said to me was, you're really a selfish, self-centered son of a bitch. Yeah. Which I thought was kind of insulting. You know, and it was the truth. But I hadn't given any thought because I really didn't do a good job on that fourth column. I didn't understand the fourth column. And the fourth column is the critical column. The fourth column is the critical column to my sobriety today. It's the absolute most important thing I can do. And I'm going to get to the rest of that in a minute. But I went back home. The book tells me take an hour, think about it, you know, and say a prayer. Do 6 and 7, you know, and then start making my list for 8 in my amends. My amends were as best as I could do them at the time, but they were mainly all about me, you know. And I've done amends again since then to many, many people to let them tell me the part of it that was all about them, because I never gave them an opportunity when I did my amends to do that. But my sponsor told me I'm going to learn to live in 10, 11, and 12. That's where I'm supposed to live when I'm all done. Some people call those the maintenance steps. I call them the growth steps. Step 10, for me, is a culmination, putting together, of steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And the big book, which spends a whopping 2 paragraphs on step 10, tells me I'm supposed to do it continuously. And it uses the word continuous 4 times in that paragraph. There's only 3 sentences in the paragraph, and it tells me 4 times it uses the word continuous. I'm supposed to be in the mode of taking a look at myself all the time. When I'm walking around, when I'm up here talking to you guys, when I'm parking the car out in the parking lot, when I wake up in the morning, it doesn't matter when. I'm supposed to be taking a look at myself. Because given my own devices, in this crazy place up here, I won't think of anything but me if I'm not taking that inventory all the time. And if I start thinking about it, you know, I was told never to go up here without adult supervision. Yeah. And I think that's exactly right. When left to my own devices, I'm not paying attention to myself. I'm not paying attention to what's going on. And this squirrel cage up here can get out of control real, real fast. Real, real fast. So and take inventory as close as I can continuously. To my way of thinking and my experiences, it takes a long time to learn how to do that. I have to work at it. I have to work at it all the time. And I'm not really, really good at it. I'm okay at it. I'm a lot better at it than I used to be. But part of taking an inventory continuously is when I screw something up, to be able to catch it as soon as I've done it and either make amends or make corrections or do whatever I got to do, watch my mouth. But as time goes on, I get better at it and I start doing the inventory when it's happening. You know? So right in the middle of a sentence, I know I can stop that sentence and start it over. And then it gets even better. I can start catching it before I do it. And that takes practice and it takes time. And that's what these steps are about, teaching me a whole new way of life, which I've encompassed as best I can. I'd say I haven't been mad since about 7:30. My point is, I'm not good at it, okay? But I'm a lot better than I was, and I keep getting better. I once heard a speaker talk about buttons, you know, the buttons that get installed on us by our parents and our wives and our siblings and our teachers and everybody else. And half those buttons we're responsible for anyway, you know? But I can tell you, I mean, I'm still married to that same lady, and now we've been married for 44 years. Good grief. And she still knows where a lot of those buttons are because she installed a lot of them. Okay? But I'm the guy that connected them. I'm the guy that connected them. Okay? I'm the guy that got on a pity pot every time she said she didn't like something. Okay? Or every time she says, hey, trash is supposed to go out. They're picking it up tomorrow. Which reminds me, they're picking it up tomorrow and I haven't taken it out yet. So I didn't like those. I felt that was pushy stuff, you know? And that button's gone. The trash button's gone anymore, okay? And over time, if I'm taking the inventory, what's happening is the buttons are starting to disappear. I'm doing that on my own. I'm doing that with the help of my higher power. Because when I catch myself, I say, oh, I don't want to do that, you know? I really don't want to do that. I want to be a better person than this. So I catch myself. Why am I going through all this? I'm going to stop right here in the middle. This guy's talking about these steps. God, it's inconvenient. I got to do an inventory. I got to watch myself all the time. I got to say, I'm sorry. Yeah. Why do I do that? It's because my go-to method of handling problems before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous was start slamming down the alcohol. That was my go-to solution all the time, for years, for decades. That's how I solved every problem in my life. Today, my go-to solution is to do the steps, and I don't get thirsty. And that's why I do this stuff. You know, and that's why we say these steps are simple, but they're not easy. They're simple to understand. But they're not easy, not in that they're impossible to do. They're not easy in that I got to keep at it to make them work. My wife and I have a better relationship today than we did when we got married. My kids are a different story because I was at the height of my alcoholism during their high school years. And I really wrecked their high school years, something terrible. You know, the big book says our kids may cordially hate us. And I think I got them back to where they just cordially hate me, you know. But that's a lot better than overtly hate me. I mean, there are times that I didn't even get Christmas presents from them. At least now I get Christmas presents and I get to play with my grandkids. As a matter of fact, last weekend my wife and I drove down to Houston and babysat for two of our teenage grandsons while their parents went to Chicago for a little celebration, you know. I wouldn't have been trusted to do that before I got sober, I can tell you. Not at all. You know, those grandkids can ride in a car with me. None of them ever seen me drunk. It's really fantastic. So the 10th step is really important. It's my everyday walking around step. You know, and that's because I have to do it. I have to do it to keep my head on straight. So then the 11th step tells me through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. And somebody in here, when somebody was reading, stopped it right there, you know. But it just goes on to say, you know, asking only, I can't remember it. Who can remember it? Not for myself, right? Only where it will help other people. All right? So God's not Santa Claus. Okay? In my opinion, God's here to help me. The higher power of my understanding really wants me to be a good human being. You know? And that's what my job is. And I get up every morning and I do some 11-step work, and pages 86, 85, 86, 87, 88, 89 tell us exactly what we're supposed to do. When we retire at night, we're supposed to take a little 11-step inventory, you know. Think about the day when we get up in the morning. When we get up in the morning, we think about the day ahead, you know, plan, where can I be useful? Where can I be useful? Those are the things I'm supposed to think about. You know, I'm lucky I'm retired. But even before I retired, I would get up early in the morning. I'd get up at 6 o'clock, and I'd read 4 pages of the Big Book every morning. Why do I read 4 pages of the Big Book? Because my sponsor told me to read 2 pages of the Big Book every morning. And if I read 2 pages of the Big Book every morning, I'm going to read it 4 times a year. That's arithmetic. Okay? And you get to know the Big Book pretty well when you start reading it like that. So, yeah, I read 4 pages a day. I read 8 times a year. So I read the Big Book 8 times a year. I don't know a whole lot of page numbers, but I sure remember a lot of sentences. And I've been through it somewhere north of 100 times. And I can tell you, every time I go through it, I see something new. A new way to look at something. You know? And quite honestly, in a way, I start off a lot of these times when I'm asked to speak, and I didn't today, but I hold up my Big Book and I say the answer to every problem I could have in my life is in the first 164 pages of this book. I heard that from a lady at a speaker meeting when I'd been sober about 6 months, and I remember thinking to myself, well, that's a bunch of crap, you know, but I can tell you today that's what I believe. You know, if I get upset about something, that I need to go read the Big Book, or I need to go take an inventory. And that doesn't mean I got to go isolate myself for a little while. I can go in the bathroom and do that real quick. I can do it in a minute. Okay? If there's other things that upset me, like politics, quit paying attention to it. Okay? Turn off the TV. When people in my family want to talk about politics with me, I tell them I don't want to talk about it. I'm not interested. It took me a long time to really mean I was not interested, but I'm not interested. And that really irritates my daughter, who's a professor of government at Lund College over at A&M, because she wants to talk about politics all the time. But I'm not interested in talking about politics. I'm not interested in talking about anything that's controversial, because I don't have a dog in that fight. Not important to me. It took a long time for me to buy into that. But it's something every one of us can do. That's my experience. And step 12, two parts of step 12. And it starts off with something. And it's got a big important word in it. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, the result, it's the only result I'm going to have from working the preceding 11 steps is have a spiritual awakening. What's a spiritual awakening? It tells me in Appendix 2. Appendix 2 says, a spiritual awakening is a change in personality sufficient to overcome drinking. Doesn't mean anything more than that in terms of the Big Book. If it means I get closer to the power greater than myself that I found, that's great. If I've gotten closer to the religion or the God of my choice, that's great. If I've gotten closer to the other people around me, that's great. I'm going to have a spiritual awakening, and I've overcome the desire to drink. Does that mean I never think about drinking? No way. I have drunk dreams. Sometimes when I go out to dinner with my wife and she orders a glass of wine and she's sitting over here and that glass of wine is right there, And the monkeys up here say, you know, you can grab that glass and dump it down your throat faster than she can even say boo. You know? And immediately behind that comes that thought that says, Ed, that's an insane thought. The power greater than myself restoring me to sanity. And why does that thought come that fast? Because it tells me that this thing will work if I stay in fit spiritual condition. You know? All I have to do is try. Don't have to be a great spiritual person. All I have to do is try. Which takes me back to the 12th step and the big word in the 12th step. The biggest word in the 12th step, in my opinion, is try. Try to carry this message to other alcoholics and to practice these principles in all my affairs. Doesn't mean I have to do it perfectly. It doesn't tell me exactly how I have to carry this message. There's a pile of ways to carry this message. Go to meetings. Talk. When a newcomer walks in, walk up to that newcomer and tell him how glad you are to see him. Because if I remember back to how scared I was when I walked in up to that first meeting, I was really scared one of those bikers was going to try and hug me. You know? But people put me at ease. People welcome me. You know, and I sit in meetings today sometimes and I watch a newcomer come in and they're scared to death and nobody says anything to them. You know, and it's really important to walk over there. And you have new people walk in here all the time. I don't know how you welcome them. But they need a hug real bad. They need to hear your name. And they need to hear them say, you know, I've been where you are. Okay. That's one way to carry this message. You know, go to meetings. Sponsor people. I've heard people say the only thing you got to do in the 12th step is all kinds of service work. Well, you know, there's all kinds of ways to do that. You can't. There aren't any meetings, to my knowledge, anymore where there's ashtrays. I scrubbed a lot of ashtrays when I first got here. You know, but you can get up in the middle of a meeting and you can go grab the coffee pot and walk around the room and fill other people's cups up. You know, you can stay for 5 minutes after the meeting and help put up stuff. Or fold up tables, or fold up chairs, or you can get there 5 minutes early, or 10 minutes early, and be the coffee maker. You know, there's lots of ways to be of service. There's lots of ways to carry this message. You can volunteer at the intergroup office. You can come back to places like this on alumni night and talk to people. There's piles of ways to carry this message. Because people who are new want to see people who have been sober for a little while. Because I don't know about you, but when I walked in here and somebody told me they'd been sober for 16 years like I am, I mean, that's a bunch of crap. He's lying. He's lying through his teeth. Nobody stays sober for 16 years. 16 hours? That's hard work. 16 years, ridiculous. So go up and talk to them, especially if you're new, and say, I've got 3 days or 5 weeks or whatever it is, and somebody can look at you and there's some real hope that you're selling when you're telling somebody that. Okay, so carry this message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all my affairs. Practicing these principles means quit being an SOB. Okay? Man, that was hard. That was really hard to do. Okay, walk into a room and the first question in your mind is, how can I be helpful? That's how I practice these principles in all my affairs. I hate to ask that question when I walk into the kitchen at home because I always get an answer with about 8 parts to it. But, you know, go to Walmart and make the clerk feel better after you've gone through the line than before you've gone through the line. Make them feel good. It's all about them, not about you, okay? Get up in the morning and say, every conversation I have today, I want to leave with the person feeling better about themselves than when the conversation started. That's my job, okay? That's hard work, you know? It's a big challenge. And I'm throwing out suggestions that I do to myself sometimes, but I'm not really, really good at it, but I'm better at it than I was when I started all this stuff. So today, I lead a life that I'm substantially happy, joyous, and free. Page 131, one of the few page numbers I remember, tells me God's will for us, we're certain that God's will for us is to be happy, joyous, and free. On a previous page, it says we absolutely insist on enjoying life. And for my own personal thing, I write it in a journal every morning. And the first sentence in my journal every morning is, today is the best day of my life. That's a prayer. It's a statement of intent. And I can tell you, I've come through most of the day today, and today is, in fact, the best day of my life. And I know that tomorrow will be even better. And it's because I got deposited in Alcoholics Anonymous when I thought dead looked good. And I lead a life today that's far better than I ever could have imagined. It tells me I'm going to get rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, and that's what's happened to me. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you tonight.